thanks for having me back to the chamber. It's been kind of a annual event here the last, well, over a decade now, I guess, starting our second decade, which, you know, it's kind of surprising because the clock ticks if we wanted to or not. So what I thought I'd do today is talk about just a few of the major issues that we worked on in the legislature this winter, and then talk a little bit about some district issues and some Southeast politics and how in Southeast, being a part of rural Alaska, we're going to have to kind of work together and deal with some of the demographic changes that are underway in Alaska and have been underway, I think, pretty much for my entire lifetime. It's just sometimes they speed up and then they slow down. But what I'd like to do is start today, and I want to leave probably 10 minutes or so. I'll try to keep an eye on the clock for questions, or 10 or 15, so you have the ability then to kind of go wherever you want to go as far as a spontaneous question and answer. And I want to talk a little bit about the oil tax issue in the state, because we have a rather unique position throughout the United States, in that Alaska is the only state that owns the subsurface rights. So all the other states are individually owned. Texas has virtually no federal land to speak of in the entire state. North Dakota's the vast majority of the oil work that's going on in North Dakota and shale is on privately owned subsurface. So we're a little different there, and we're also a little different in the magnitude of our hydrocarbon basin and just the sheer volume of it. Prudhoe Bay, being a supergiant field, is one of the top 10 most prolific fields in the world. And it's also the largest conventional oil field in North America. The second largest conventional oil field in North America is Kuparuk. So when you take a look at the structure of the state and the ownership interest and then the size of the issue or the hydrocarbons we have, we have a unique opportunity that is not presented to the other states. Normally they're held at the national level. So most of our comparative universes are dealing with federal governments around the world, not so much at the local level or the state level. So it leads to some of the discussion in the press as far as who and why we would compare to North Dakota or Texas or what have you. And I know there's been some presentations given here at the chamber over the last couple of years from other folks, and it's a real commonality to talk about North Dakota and Texas, and that's why I'm bringing it up. All the other states are on a tax and royalty system. We have initially, and that's pretty much unique to the world. The western part, North America, is a tax and royalty base. The rest of the world pretty much is not. The vast majority of it, they're on concession contracts, profit sharing contracts, or service contracts, where they're paid per barrel to produce oil. And that per barrel number could go all the way down $1 a barrel to $2 a barrel on the extreme side. So we were left with some historic tax and royalty contracts when we opened Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk that still, in my opinion, haunt us today. And when Frank Murkowski came in and started before him with Governor Knowles, and they started looking at the tax structure, because the tax structure in the state of Alaska was at such a great disadvantage to the state, it needed to be adjusted. And the industry recognized that, and the state certainly recognized it. And that started the ball rolling that took place in under Knowles and Murkowski, and came out with the PPT, or production tax, which is a concession contract. And that contract then was again modified under Palin with ACES. So that's kind of a brief history of where we got today. I think the industry was taken by surprise with PPT under Murkowski, that the legislature actually upped the ante a little bit from what Murkowski had put on the table. And then obviously the adjustment in ACES took their breath away. And the main components of this tax structural change was taking a risk-sharing opportunity where Alaska would put in some credits. They would supplant some of the capital expenditures. Could be 20% for the legacy fields on up to 40%. Plus, so if you bought a $100,000 piece of machinery, except we're working in hundreds of millions and billions up there, the state would, in that place, a $100 example, would replace 20% of your capital cost. Plus, you take a deduction and some other things. So you'd end up with about 40 cents on the dollar invested. Well, with the state taking that type of upfront help in the development, they also took a higher percentage of the profit as the profit expanded. Well, the industry didn't like that much once they realized that the oil price went to areas that they weren't anticipating, north of $100. And when you look at $130, $140 a barrel under the current system we have today, which is going to be changed unless the people step in, that percentage, most of that dollar change or profit gain reverted back to the state, and the industry didn't like that at all. They thought a fair splitting, and frankly, I think in the broad context, I would agree with them that progressivity rate is too expensive or too high a slope, too onerous for the industry, that takes too much of the upside away at high oil prices and distorts some of their economic models and takes away their incentive to a certain degree. The other side of the coin, or the other major component that's in the discussion, is these credits, where the state in FY 13 we're looking at, and 14, if we didn't change the tax, was looking around $800 million in capital expenditures to supplant back to the industry, and that's quite a hit on the treasury. And if oil prices declined into the $70-$60 range, we'd be in trouble because we'd have this call on the treasury of right under $1 billion, and we'd have to meet it. So there was, and it's extremely heavy, if not the most heavy compensation that a sovereign puts back to the industry in credits worldwide. Either that or maybe number two. It's way off the charts. So we have a progressivity problem, taking too much of the high end north of like 120, 130, 140 barrels, and we have too heavy of a credit. So in fixing, going through the tax proposal and adjusting the tax through the legislative process, Senate Bill 21 was the prevailing vehicle. And in my opinion, with that piece of legislation, it fixed some of the major problems, but they had the opportunity then for to, in my opinion, shift too much of the value that the state has in their legacy fields back to the industry. And you hear all kinds of numbers out there, people talking about how much it costs to extract the oil. You'll have heard in the press that they talked about $50 a barrel oil, $60 a barrel oil to get it. And that is for newer oil outside of the legacy fields, and they have a challenge under their tax code currently under the ACES, so that is fixed. You go back up to the blended, which is what you'd expect, the old fields and the new fields, you're down into about $30 range. But if you take and peel all that stuff out and go back and take a look at Prudhoe Bay in itself, because that's where the oil is and that's where the money's at, and Kuparik, they're about $20, a little less than $20 in FY13 to get that oil out of the ground. So if you ran this tax model through the 2012 real price of oil, production costs of oil, and you just look at Prudhoe and Kuparik, you would see $1.7 billion moving from the state to the industry, $1.7 billion. Not $500 million, not 600 million, not 700 million. Virtually all of that oil produced in 2012 was economic. They're not producing the uneconomic oil. And they're pretty clear about that. And we recognize that. And I think we fixed that. But this is economic oil. So if it costs you $9 to ship it down the pipeline and send it across on the oil tanker to sell it, and it costs you, just round it off, just say $20 in operating and capital expenditures, you're at $30 a barrel. And I think that's a little high too when you actually start drilling down into some of these numbers, because some of the consultant numbers that we've seen are actually less than that. But just give the benefit to the industry and say it's $30. Oil today is at $100. You don't need to move $1.7 billion. It doesn't fix anything. So it was, in my opinion, quite a gift to the industry. And they have not come forward and expressed any definitive terms on or timelines on what they're going to actually produce for that, as far as increased production. And if you actually sat down and figured out what it's going to take to produce areas that don't have very much oil at all compared to Prudhoe, it's virtually mathematically impossible for the state to ever recoup that money. So that's kind of in a nutshell why I don't agree with Senate Bill 21. It's not that that the structure of the bill itself is flawed. I think it's a good concept. It cleans up a lot of issues. It addresses the uneconomic areas. And if you look at a splitting between the government portion and the industry portion, that splitting of profits and all costs, including royalties, is about 60%. Call it 60% government take number. The legacy fields should be at 70 or north of 70. I've advocated something a little slightly less than 70. We're currently down at around 65 in this bill. And it doesn't sound like much percentages, but when you're working with billions of dollars, you're moving a lot of money. So unfortunately, there was a lot of discussion this year in the news and in a lot of the meetings on just the government take aspect of it. What's our sharing? Our sharing should be 60% for new fields and 65% of the legacy fields, which was the kind of the standard line. The challenge with that, it doesn't take into account your resources. It doesn't take in, and we recognize the Arctic's high costs. We don't have revolutions, so you got to recognize that. We have a stable judiciary branch. You got to take care of that. We've got shipping transportation across the Pacific that can be protected by our U.S. Navy. We don't have to go through choke points. You got to take into account that. You certainly have to take into account one of the top 10 most prolific oil fields on the planet. This is not North Dakota. So once you take away a lot of those issues, which you actually have to blend in to come up with this government take number, you don't just, you know, talk about a government take number in, the sharing relationship. You don't just take a look at the government take number in itself. You have to look at all these other components, both advantages that we have and disadvantages. You seem to hear a lot about the disadvantages we have. So anyway, that's kind of in a nutshell why I feel there's more work to be done on this issue in the future. I think when the people realize that we're going to run this year, after we get at the fiscal notes, and I'll get into that in a minute, when we take into account all expenditures hit the Treasury for this fiscal year of 14, we should be deficit spending by about $1.4 billion, maybe $1.5. Ledge Finance is working on those numbers, and they won't have them for a few weeks. It's going to be somewhere in that range. Could be as high as 1.6. So just pick 1.4 billion a year. Ledge Finance estimates next year will be about $1 billion negative, and that billion is going to increase or decrease. The hole's going to get deeper and deeper every year for the foreseeable future. We have roughly $16 billion in savings outside of the permanent fund that we could access. And when that money's gone, it's not going to be a very pleasant work environment in Juneau, I think, to deal with some of that stuff. about a third of that extra cash needs to be held for the retirement system, which is about 12 to 14 billion underfunded, depending on what number you want to use, a smoothing number, average back several years, or a market to market. But you need somewhere around 5, 6 billion bucks to take care of that. So that leaves you about 10 billion to take care of the state needs. So those that are concerned are going to get more concerned about budget reductions because they're coming, and they didn't come this year. There may be some fairly substantial draws on the Treasury next year because it's an election year to try to cover it, but it's coming, and it's going to hit K-12, and it's going to hit Health and Human Services, and it's going to hit the university, and it should have changed that order because the HES budget is the largest in the state. Next is K-12, next is a university. It's easy to go in and cut DOT road maintenance, but you can't save enough money out of cutting road maintenance. All you do is beat up people's cars. You can't cut out the fish and game comp fish budget, commercial fish budget, because there's general funds in there. Because you can't shut down that industry. So you're going to be forced into going into these areas. So my expectation is you're going to have a substantial squeezing of these budgets. And we do have a problem in the operating budget, and I've stood here, I think, every year for almost 10 years, probably 8 of the 10, and I've mentioned that. It's grown way too fast under Palin. I think 1 year was almost 16%. Parnell's got this year down to about 1 or 2. We'd have to cut next year $125 million just to stay flat with this year. The state's never cut $125 million in any year. Ever. So it'll be interesting to see if that's going to happen. But let me jump off of oil and hit a little bit about the capital budget. We've got our challenges, as I think everybody in this room recognizes. There's now 27 communities in our district, because we have all from Haines to Hyder, basically Haines to Dixon entrance. And we don't have Petersburg and Juneau and Skagway and Gus Davis and Tanaki, pretty much everybody else. A lot of those districts or communities in the district have a lot of needs, and we're going to have to try to cover more bases with less money. So when we did this year's capital budget, the largest issue here, of course, is Blue Lake, and I knew there was no chance of getting funding for Blue Lake. And the second one, which was actually the number one with potential, was the filter plant, $6 million for the filter plant, and that didn't happen. In the region, in the district Q, the two top items was the Ketchikan Hospital and the filter plant here in Sitka. The hospital ended up with half of their funding request, and that was it as an additive on the Senate side of the capital budget. We in the Senate cut up $200 million, and that was the allocation that came in. I think I submitted the letter to, or the list to the Finance Committee Chairman end of February. So it was pretty early. So that's kind of how that played out. We ended up with virtually nothing added in this House district. So what we did is we went in and reappropriated money from different projects around to try to move money to keep some things going. One of which was the Mount Edgecombe swimming pool. Another one in the district was a health center in Hoonah. Both those funds came from a Hoonah dock that was 100% funded. But quite frankly, when you 100% fund any project like that, you end up with unforeseen problems. That will leave that project about 50% funded, and the project can move forward with the support of the industry and issue some revenue bonds and pay for that project, and that way they'll get a dock that the industry wants and the community wants, and you end up with a better project. So we were fairly treated in the capital budget as far as what was added and We were fairly treated in the governor's initial submission. I think the whole region in Southeast. Where we weren't treated fairly, and this was all of rural Alaska, is in the other mechanism, which is the fiscal notes. So you can, for instance, give you an example. If you have a big project and I want to build a dam at Blue Lake, I could put it in the capital budget. I think we've got $49.5 million the state has put into Blue Lake project. And that's the standard way of doing it. The other way of doing it is I could put in a piece of legislation and say, Jim Denley, Sitka, go build Blue Lake, send me the bill. Senator Stedman, thank you very much. And a piece of legislation, get it passed. He goes out and builds a dam, sends us the bill. We fund it through a fiscal note in the legislation. And the rail belt colleagues of mine took out about $500 million in funding for energy issues in the rail belt through fiscal notes. And that left all of rural Alaska pretty much left out. There was no discussion of rural issues, rural energy issues. And that handwriting was on the wall, let's say, later part of January. And by the end of February, in the first week in March, it motivated or encouraged the coastal and rural legislators within the Senate majority to come together and more formally put together the coastal caucus. Because in the Senate, it takes 11 votes to do anything in the House, 21. And if you have 11 in the Senate, you don't need the other 9. And if all 11 of you are from one area of the state, well, you can just ignore the entire rest of the state, which is basically what happened. Well, when the Coastal Caucus was put together, there was Senator Stevens out of Fairbanks, Donnie Olson out of Nome. Kodiak. And Dennis Egan out of Juneau, and myself. Anyway, we put that group together, and then shortly after that, Senator Machiki, a new guy out of Kenai, and he's kind of like in the rail belt but not in the rail belt. He's got his roads connected in Kenai, but there's not a lot of similarities. He is very interested in commercial fishing. He wanted to be a member, so that brought the number to 5. Well, once you have 5, and there's 15 in the majority, it doesn't take a mathematician to figure out you can't get to 11. So to move something without one of the coastal caucus members agreeing and moving on with that issue. So that changed the dialogue internally within the Senate. Changed your attitudes, quite frankly. We will continue to work together and work on that relationship, and it takes time because some of us have worked together, Olson, Stevens, and myself for 11 years. Most of the time in the same majority group. There was a few of those years Olson was in the minority 8 years or so ago, 9 years ago, and then Machiki's a new guy. Egan has, been in there a few years, 4 years or so. So as this group coalesces and comes together, you'll see some of our rural issues on the table, or we'll just hopefully start blocking and shutting down the system. But the only thing you're going to do, because it's pretty apparent that there isn't a lot of interest in rural issues, even in discussions. So that was the impetus that moved this group together. And it's the urban and rural. And some people get really confused because there's the Republicans and the Democrats, and we fight like cats and dogs, and that's just what we do. And then there's the urban and the rural, and we do the same thing. And then you get all of them at the table, around a table like this, in a circle, and we're going at it. It's, when you first come in, it's hard to figure out why a Democrat or why a Republican support this issue or that issue, because you get them mixed up at the same time. But we have some major issues that we have to deal with, one of which is the Marine Highway. The rail belt is not concerned about the Marine Highway. I can assure you that. If they shut it down, their phones don't ring. That gets shut down, and I can guarantee you my phone's going to ring. So you know, as we look at these funding reductions coming at us, the Marine Highway needs new ships, and we've got two new ships. We thought we were going to have one, but now we're going to have two. The governor wants two smaller ones. The appropriation's been made from the legislature, $120 million. It's in the governor's lap. He can build what he wants. I'm not going to fight with him over what he's going to build. I'll give him recommendations or some of my concerns as far as sea states and shelters, you know, ability to have a shelter deck on it for your automobile, stuff like that. But my main concern is we get some ships built. We've also took, last year we put up another $50 million away for a total for the Marine Highway of $170. 50 of it for new construction of ships outside the Alaska class, which was then converted to this two-ship deal. We took $10 million out of that this year to do some design work on the Testacamina. And Osterman out of Kodiak asked me about that, and I told him that was fine. They could take that money out. Thought it was a good thing to get that ball rolling. The Testacamina is probably going to be the next ship replaced. But what we need to do is we need another 50, preferably this year, and every year add 50 and 50 and 50 and 50 because we've got, you know, several ships to replace. It's a extremely difficult political task if they come in and say, we want $125 million to build a new ship in 1 year. You would have to go into your, you know, and you're already running a deficit. So you're running a deficit of $1 billion. Now you need another $100 million for a ferry for Southeast. Good luck getting the votes. It's just going to be difficult. So that's where the Coastal Caucus, as an example, will come in. We're also not very happy with the way, we're concerned. We're concerned with the commercial Board of Fish, the Board of Fish, the commercial representation. So I think we'll have some dialogue about that coming up. In fact, there was a guy that was, a lot of us thought, not treated fairly when he wasn't reappointed to the Board of Fish. Rejected by the legislature, basically by the rail bell guys, for no apparent good reason, other than, you know, he's an easy target, and that was right before the coalition or the coalescence of the coastal group, and it was just became apparent to a lot of people in the state just the politics, you know, when you're sitting there, when you have to actually vote in public, it was glaringly apparent. Want to touch on one other thing, maybe a couple other things. We've got some big projects going on and up in town, and we're all aware of that. And we're not going to quit working on dealing with funding help for Blue Lake. That's going to be an ongoing process for the next several years. There's been discussions with AEA, Alaska Energy Authority, and their involvement. And discussions with them, we've got to basically get them on board, get the OMB, Director of Finance for the governor on board, and then get the governor on board to get anything done. And I think the first nut to crack is going to be the AEA. And they're a little challenging. I think they would have been happier if we just burned pellets, which doesn't quite work because you can't run electric motors on pellets. So we'll work on that. There is some concern that we've got, a coalescence of all these big projects, you know, Salmo Creek, Halibut Point, Blue Lake, airport paving all coming together at once for some big kabang in town. And that just happenstance, I guess, that's what's going on. But there's projects on the other side of that. We've got a driving range that we're trying to get into the queue for appropriations for the Trooper Academy up Indian River Valley, which will be a nice project, and it's probably $5-6 million. We have a swimming pool at Mount Edgecombe that we added another $6+ million to this year to get built. That'll be, we got a little over $32 million rounded off set aside for it. They might need a few pennies more, so we're working on that. I think they're trying to I'm a little concerned on the monkey business with that project, but we're going to work on that to make sure that they're not going to consume a bunch of that on environmental cleanup over there, and
other legacy issues that, that those funds are not supposed to be used for, or wasn't in the concept of being used for. And we've got the road issue to try to get to some property out in Catlin Bay and open up some quarrying activity and hopefully some export activity. The region is in dire need of hard rock and other quarrying material. If, you know, we can get some access to it, I think there's an opportunity that'll last for decades. And then there's other residual issues as far as fish enhancements and other things that can go on out there. So we're still, you know, going to be going forward with projects outside of this Salmo Creek and Halibut Point Road and Blue Lake and the airport. But they're going to be smaller in scale. And we'll continue to work with City Hall and with AEA and try to come up with how we're going to get a solution for Blue Lake. Because if the, to give you an example, and then I'm going to stop for a question, give you an example in this year's capital budget, Watonna Dam for the rail belt, basically Anchorage and Matsu, $92.5 million in the capital budget this year, cash. Every penny of that project, and there's probably 100, and, I don't know if it's 150, 170 now, it's been appropriated for it. It's all cash, none of this 50-50, you know, half from City Hall, half from the state. It's all state for Matsu and Anchorage. And that project's probably an $8 billion project. So there's probably half of that total, or a third of it, is going to be equity from the state at the end of the day. And that's just an example of how egregious the, in my opinion, the looting of the treasury for the rail belt was this year. And I don't think they appreciate guys like myself standing up and pointing that out. But I haven't seen that type of activity since the first year I went over in the Senate 11 years ago. And I don't think it's good for the entire state. We need to lift all boats you know, throughout the state when we have good economic times. And when times get tight, you treat everybody the same and you scale back everything. You don't just scale back, you know, particular areas. So, in the closing note, I've had brief discussions with the governor on this subject several months ago, and pointed out to him that he needs to keep an eye on it and step in as the governor when he sees this type of activity going on. So, we'll see how that all plays out. He treated us fairly, I think, in his capital budget process, the district and the region, all the Southeast. So with that, I thank him for that, and I'll continue to argue with him over oil politics. And with that, I'd like to open it up for questions, and it could be anything you guys want to ask about. Jay.
Bert, I'd like to tell you I really appreciate all your homework you've done on the oil tax issue, and my question is, what are the ramifications of the referendum on SB 21?
If they get the signatures, they got 90 days, less than that now, maybe 70 or something. If they get the signatures, it'll go to the vote of the people. If the people vote to reject SB 21, then we'll be back on ACES, the current tax structure that we have today. We still have the issue of high progressivity and credits. We go back in and we fix that, and we keep an eye on the cash cow, the legacy fields of Prudhomme Kupari.
When would the election be?
I think it'd be this fall. I think so.
Summer of
2014. Okay, a year from
the primary.
Right, August, mm-hmm. Next August. Yeah.
So, thank you.
I'm going to sign that thing if it comes around. That's my opinion of it. Yes, you have a question? Anybody else have a question? Anybody want to? Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to just personally thank you what you've done for the city and also for me. You've been a real pleasure to work with, and I don't know that everybody appreciates how much you're 5% of the Senate, and we've got many, many times that 5%, and my staff appreciates it, and I certainly do. One is a close personal friend, but also someone that's pretty damn effective in Juneau, and I think that's really, that's commendable, and everybody ought to know that.
Thanks. I will
say this, and I was going to mention it earlier, you know, as we, that location for the capital budget this year all went into one house district. That can't happen all the time. We've got to move things around. As another example, Angoon was totally left out when we reappropriated some money. And there's a bunch of other communities too, but Angoon was you know, town of roughly around 500. So we need to take a look at this from year to year and try to keep fairness, and there will be times when some communities are added and some are left out, and hopefully when we, you know, look at it multi-years, everybody will feel that they were, you know, treated fairly. But I appreciate your comment.
Yeah, Senator, does it hurt our House district that we don't have someone in the majority in the House?
Well, if I was in the minority, my portion of the capital budget would have been zero. And we had quite a bit of, not quite a bit, we've had some discussion and help with Jonathan's staff on projects in the district because they're new to it, process and stuff, helping them. And he got $80,000 for the Pelican Dock. So when you see that list, that's where that came from. But clearly, you know, it's a majority game. No doubt about that. It's hard enough in the majority when you're fighting the rail belt. But if you're, you know, if you're in the minority in from Anchorage, it doesn't matter because you've got a bunch of majority members in Anchorage, takes care of Anchorage. So the Anchorage majority members in the Senate, Ellis, French, Wilikowski, and so on and so forth, Anchorage is going to get taken care of anyway. But it's a partisan game. There's no doubt about that. And full contact sport.
I got to, yes, sir. Thank you for all your work. I got to attend the economic forum the other day, and the three top vote getters. Number one was the city working with the water business. Number two was looking at SJ campus and the potential it has, and the third was mining. And I always ask you, what are you thinking about SJ campus?
I think the chance of getting funding for that is near zero. The chance of getting funding for the district's going to be tough, and it's going to be spread out. If the city made it the number one thing over their roads and all the other maintenance, that when the assembly makes their prioritized list, I would say that that's, you know, that's the local process, and we're going to take a look at that. For all 27 communities, rank the same. You know, the chance of getting funding going forward when we're running deficits, I don't think it's very likely at all. But we'll wait and see, you know, what the local list is. But this year, I had a book this thick, literally, in the Senate district. I had one project. I mean, that's hopefully not going to happen again, but because, and I've talked to the community of Ketchikan too, you know, I mean, it was a huge, huge project, and it's region-wide for the southern part, but still, maybe it would have been 4 or 5 spread out through the whole district. So it's a different era. So there is ramifications of moving a lot of money out of the treasury. You don't need to move to fix problems. Yes,
Senator. You know, the oil tax changes is, you know, frankly not very popular across the state with voters. And as these operating cuts come in, and the Rail Belt Coalition, you know, tries to steer more of that money up there, it just seems to me overall, when the pie is so much smaller, there's going to be a lot of unhappiness with people. And you, the statements you have made in the legislature, you've done your homework, you know this oil tax stuff front and back, and you speak across party lines, Democrats and Republicans listen to you, and I think highly of you. Have down the road, have you thought about considering Governor Stedman in the future? Because I think you'd have a heck of a shot at that, the way this state is going.
The Republican Party is heavily dominated by oil service company contributions. That pretty much puts it in a nutshell.
People vote.
you know, it's a money machine, and if you're Wally Hickel and you have your own purse, but he is an anomaly within the system. So, but quite frankly, I'd rather, you know, speak up and stand up for the people that own the resource than roll over and play dead and pretend this isn't going on. I think it's egregious as hell. But it's a political process. Also, you know, that bill passed 11-9 in the Senate. They moved the maximum amount of cash they could move and get the minimum amount of votes. You couldn't move any more cash or you wouldn't get the 11 votes. It's another way of looking at it. And believe me, this game is, you know, you sit down in a, you know, in these fiscal classes on oil economics, it's all about net cash to the company. That's all these credits and royalties and crypto taxes, all this stuff is just moving money back and forth. And the basin's worth about $20 billion a year. The fishing industry grossed 4.8 last year. 4.8. This place nets over 10 cash. We're arguing that well. These are huge, huge dollars. Normally they don't put it in total dollar terms because people's eyes bug out. So anyway, you know, some of us are not, well, I wasn't here, but, you know, several generations ago it was canned salmon wars. You know, Alaska's always struggled with dominance. Fur trade, same thing. You know, people come in. It doesn't change. But we have a vast resource up there. They're going to be harvesting hydrocarbons for generations. We have an opportunity like the Gulf of Mexico has. And it's all over, off of Siberia and off of Canada. So the pipeline's not going anywhere.
But one other comment. I appreciate your candor. It's nice to have someone, you know, a lot of politicians don't want to tell you the bad side, but it's nice when, you know, someone is willing to just say, hey, this is going to be tough. And on the other, on the oil taxes, I think most people that I talk to, Senator, they're not opposed to giving oil companies breaks to go into new fields. They understand the costs, that we should give them a break to help fill the pipeline. But I think with you, what we did with the legacy fields was wrong, giving them money on the legacy fields. So it's just my thought, and I'll sign the petition as well.
Yeah, but it'll be another day. I mean, this, you know, we gather up once a year in Juneau and wrestle it out. Oil issues not going away. It'll die down for a while, but possibly we'll go from there. But I do thank everybody for coming today on a dreary, dreary, rainy day. And it's nice to see the local folks come out and have the opportunity then to be able to just take questions. And thank you.